Time for a sofa upgrade? Introducing Anabe Sofas, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices. Every Anabe sofa is modular, allowing you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabe is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slide right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today. Sofas start at just $699 with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get early access to Black Friday now. The biggest sale of the year can save you up to 60% off, plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Don't you love her madly? Don't you need her badly? Don't you love her ways? Tell me what you say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second edition of the Packers Podcast. I am Michael Cohen, here, as always, with Bob McGinn. We're happy to be with you for a second consecutive week here, and we'll hope to keep that going throughout training camp and the regular season. Bob, the PGA is upon us, but I will say, there was a little bit of a professional exhibition of golf up in Crivitz last weekend, wasn't there?
We had a good time up there.
We did.
At the track known as Hunter's Glen.
For those who don't remember, Bob and I recorded the podcast a week ago Sunday, and we immediately shipped, 50 miles north?
We did, yeah.
50 miles north up there to Crivitz. And tell people about the track a little bit for those that haven't been there.
It's a nice course, carved in the North Woods, big vacation area up there by the Peshtigo River, straight north on 141 out of Green Bay, 50 miles. Hunter's Glen, I think it's been up there about 25 years. I really like the place. I play there almost every year. Been there a lot. Links on the front, right, Mike?
Links on the front, and it's deceptively manageable for the first six, eight, nine holes.
I'll say four holes.
You'll say four, okay.
All right.
Okay. The first beginning, it gives you a false sense of confidence before ripping out your innards on the back nine of a very woods-type layout on the back?
You turn east on... after 10 green, you turn right, and then
then you better check how many lost balls you have, how many you got left in the bag.
397 par 4, number 11, through the woods, tight on the right, and from there it just gets worse.
It gets worse and worse and worse. So do we want to share what the scores were?
Go for it, Mike.
I shot a 95. Bob, what'd you shoot?
98.
And what was your downfall?
42 putts with 8-3 putts.
Eight 3-putts on 18 holes. Bob was finding every way to navigate the greens and cover as much land area as possible.
I have used the same ping answer putter, I believe, for 41 years. And after that round, the clubs are washed. They're put away for good till next May. I believe I'm going to buy a new putter.
You said it's a ping answer putter?
Yep.
It's not the answer anymore.
It apparently is not.
You need a new one, Bob.
I'm making a move.
Are you going to go to one of those fat grips like they use on the PGA
Tour? I'll try anything at this point.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. But after that wonderful display up in Crivitz, you were so inspired by the high level of golf that you went down to Whistling Straits. Is that correct?
Wednesday for practice day. Been to a lot of normal days at golf tournaments. Never been to a practice day. Went down with a couple of buddies from up north in the UP. And we had a blast. It was like 79 degrees. We were there for 8 hours, sun the whole day.
Did you follow one? Did you follow one group around, or did you try and see as many guys as you could?
No, you don't know. Practice days, there's no, you know, the caddies don't have bibs. There's nothing on the scoreboard. A little bit in the beginning, you can see a sign, but you're just kind of out there looking at bags, names on golf bags, and guys you see. I'd say during those 8 hours, we probably saw. We started at 11 a.m. We left around 6 or 7. Saw 75% of the people, at least laid eyes on them that you'd want to see.
It's amazing to watch the way they strike the ball up close, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's something different than the way you and I do it.
I love golf tournaments. The highlight of the day.
Highlight of the day.
We're there. It was about noon. We'd been there an hour. We're out on number 8. 507, par 4, with the wind, number 8. We're out in the middle of the fairway. We're seeing Mickelson, Ricky Fowler, and Scott Piercy. Piercy was hitting first. Now, the drive had been downwind. I'm going to say his drive went 300, 295. So okay. He's got about 212, 207 left. Now, I was estimating he would have hit a 6-iron with the wind. But seeing some stuff in the last couple days on TV, it could have been a 7 or an 8. I mean, seriously. All right, so we're watching him. He's about 20 yards away from us. And I followed the flight of this ball. It can be hard to see, but I saw this one. And it was a draw. And it hit the green, rolled about, bounced about 3 times, and then started rolling right to left. The thing went in.
Had you ever seen a shot hold from the fairway before, live?
Yeah, but not 210.
Right.
This is an eagle. Now, because the wind was blowing with the shot, there was probably about 150 people around the green, but you couldn't hear them react. Because the wind, you know, it didn't. And so we just started shouting. I did. And my buddy, we just couldn't believe it. And Piercy then starts flapping his wings, trying to get everybody else to start talk.
Were Mickelson and Fowler impressed?
Yes, they were. It was an extreme. I mean, how many times in his life has Scott Piercy hold a shot that long?
Well, Scott Piercy was
several.
Scott Piercy was the name of the guy who taught me driver's ed, and I can tell you it wasn't him.
But how many times? I mean, you know, he's had a great golf career starting at age 5 probably, but you know, he's probably made some shots like that.
I'm sure he
but
has.
Not many.
And probably not in a major.
No.
It was impressive.
You'll remember.
It
was so impressive. That was good.
You told me about it. I looked up the highlight, and it was quite a shot.
It was on the highlight from a practice run?
It was on YouTube.
Was it really?
Yeah, I found it on YouTube.
Okay. Yeah.
Or it may have been one of those quick little clips that they show you on Twitter now. I'm not sure if it was YouTube or Twitter, but I did see it, and it was a heck of a shot.
Yep.
Heck of a shot. But now that we've got that out of the way, let's get to the real business, and that, of course, is the music selection.
Thank
that
you, Michael.
Made today, you thought I forgot about it, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I was in a panic.
No, we're gonna get there, and I'm not even gonna say anything. You tell us what that song was and why you chose it.
The Doors, 1971, "Lover Madly." It was the soundtrack of my summer. The Doors. On Father's Day night at the restored Meyer Theater in downtown Green Bay, it's about 1,200 seats. My wife and I dragged her to the Doors tribute band, Soft Parade. Why Soft Parade? I think it was their fourth of like 9 albums. That was the name of it, Soft Parade. They had the sound. They had the look. They had the clothes. They had the swag. Ray Manzarek over there on keyboard looks like he was over there in the person of this guy. Robbie Krieger on guitar. The drummer was good. There was one problem. The lead singer, he had the sound pretty good of Morrison, but he didn't have the look. They've been together 25 years. So maybe he did have the look when they started out, but I'm going to peg him at like 6'1", 235, you know? He was turning his back on the audience, Mike. He had the, you know, the ugliness, you know, the the meanness, but he just didn't have the look, and it kind of hurt the show.
6'1", 235. Could he have played a little backer?
Maybe
did he look stiff?
Maybe a D3 nose tackle or something.
D3 nose tackle? Okay. Okay. But then you heard the Doors, you liked the show, and you went to the CD exchange.
Yes, I did, and I bought the Doors in concert and the Doors' Greatest Hits.
And then it was the soundtrack of your summer from there.
Like on the golf course for 2 or 3 weeks, I mean, I just was hearing these songs in my head constantly. It's kind of subsided a little bit, but now that I knew I was going to have this song, I was playing them again all yesterday.
How did you arrive on "Love Her Madly" as the choice? Was it a difficult choice?
Very. It was very. I went through the start of all those, you know, greatest hits and the concert. "Crystal Ship" was just a tough call against the Alabama Whiskey song. That was right in there. But, you know, this has got, it's got that quirky keyboard sound of Mr. Manzarek, who recently passed away, I think, within the last year or two. And Morrison's vocals are good, and it's upbeat.
And it's perfect for a 45-second intro, which you told me was one of the deciding mm-hmm. factors.
All right, so what do you know about the Doors, Michael?
I'll be honest with you, I don't know a whole lot. You know, they're the type of band where, obviously, when you hear one of their songs, you recognize it right away if you're a fan of the classic rock genre. But that, it's one of those bands where if you name a song, as you were trying to do yesterday when we were out on the practice field, I can't necessarily picture it right away when you name the song, mm-hmm. but as soon as you hear it, it's something you know you've mm-hmm. heard before. So you told me Lover Madly was the song. I went into iTunes, I made the purchase, and immediately I knew it, and I was even able to sing along with parts of it. But mm-hmm. when you told me the title out on the field, it didn't necessarily register right away. Sure. But they're one of those bands that it's just the sound is so distinctive that whether you like it or not, you know it instantly. And yeah. I'm sure that helped their popularity over the yeah. years.
Only four members, you know, one guitar. And I think I talked to my son-in-law, and I think the bass comes from the keyboard somehow.
Really?
That's where that comes from.
That could be true.
The guy was incredibly talented. That you know more true. About this music business?
Yeah. But, I mean, obviously, yeah. you know, keyboard players, they're going to play usually with their left hand on the low side and the right hand on the high side. Mm. So you can get a bass line out of the left hand. You can walk mm. and have a bass line there. And then up high is where you have usually the melody or the, you know, the solo, if it's a particular solo and stuff like that. So it's definitely possible that the bass came from the keyboard. Mm. I, you know, that's more than I knew about the Doors. So yeah. we'll have to look that up and see how it goes.
I mean, some young listeners might not know. You know, Jim Morrison died of, well, nobody really knows what he died of, in Paris in 73. And as you know, that's one of the most visited grave sites anywhere in the world, right? People yep. are leaving stuff there every day.
Have you seen any other tribute bands over the years?
My son-in-law, he has a Pink Floyd tribute band.
Okay.
I've seen a Beatles. Now, you've seen some Beatles tribute band, right?
I have, yes. I've seen multiple Beatles tribute bands over the years. I saw one at in a fairground setting in a town a couple of minutes over from me called Harwinton, Connecticut. It was a Beatles tribute band there that was really, really good. They had the look. They had the costumes. You know, the mannerisms. It was really enjoyable. And then, you know, my dad was a huge Beatles fan, his favorite band of all time, you know, bar none. He knows all the songs, all the lyrics, everything. And he used to take me to Beatle conventions, actually. You know, these just big, giant festivals where there's Beatle memorabilia and museum-type setups and exhibits and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so there was a tribute band there. So I've seen at least two, and I want to say I saw a third at one point as well. So I've seen my fair share of Beatles tribute bands, and even though you know, it was a little bit forced upon me by my dad because it was his favorite choice, I have to admit, I love the Beatles. I'm mm-hmm. hooked, man. One of my favorite bands of all time.
Awesome.
Well,
all right.
Should we get to what people, I guess, are supposed to be subscribing to listen to?
I suppose we better, huh, Michael?
Okay. All right. So one of the first things that I noticed from that opening exhibition game against the Patriots last week in New England, obviously Bob and I were there along with Tom, our third colleague, was right away, first play of the game, Aaron Rodgers sacked. And came from that left side, left tackle there, David Bakhtiari, beaten by Chandler Jones. And I know you went back and looked at the film, and you noticed that wasn't the first time that Bakhtiari was beaten that night, was he?
No. You know, that one too, Michael, the first one was 3.5 seconds on the sack from, you know, snap to sack. That ball probably could have been out, probably should have been out. 3.5 is too long on that. Now, I'm not exonerating Bakhtiari. He's got to do a better job of that, but Rodgers held that ball. So, yeah, that was a bad start. Chandler Jones is, you know, really good player. He did not play against the Packers in that game November 30th, and that certainly weakened the Patriot rush.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with Chandler Jones, a Syracuse product. We overlapped in school there, so I covered him for a couple of years. You know, I've actually met both of his siblings as well, Arthur, who played a lot for the Ravens, and Arthur's with the Colts
Where'd
now?
Where'd he go? Maybe.
I think he might be with the Colts now. And then John Jones, obviously, the mixed martial arts fighter and former UFC champion. So I'm very familiar with that family. You know, Chandler did a lot of the things that night in his brief two series there that you saw at Syracuse with just a lot of athleticism off the line of scrimmage and really quick twitch movements there that made him a first-round draft pick, correct? First-round pick?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, backed by the Patriots. So we saw a little bit of concern with Bakhtiari. He was beaten a couple times there. He actually gave up a second sack later in the game as well. And then we saw a little bit out of the backups. Tell us about there. Another tackle who struggled a bit for the Packers.
And one thing I will mention about Bakhtiari, you know, he didn't practice yesterday with a knee injury.
Oh, that's right. I forgot all about that.
We're doing this Sunday afternoon, so he didn't practice Saturday. We don't know if that affected him during the game or not.
Absolutely.
Could have.
He was at practice. He wasn't wearing any kind of a brace or anything.
No.
But he wasn't there in terms of participation. And like you said, we have no idea if that was an injury that he was you know, maybe worried about during the game, or he suffered it during the game. So we'll have to see what happens as his status progresses here through camp.
So,
but I started to ask you about another tackle that struggled a little bit for the Packers.
So then after Blaga left after 33 snaps at right tackle, then Don Barkley came in at right tackle. And it was Don's first game, his first game since the 2013 playoffs. Yeah, because he got hurt August 5th last year with the blown ACL. And Don had had some up-and-down days in training camp. That one of his down days was the scrimmage in the stadium a week ago. And in this game, he had some more problems. And, you know, it wasn't very good in protection, and he was late, and he just struggled getting his hands inside.
Yeah, there was one particular play where Rufus Johnson, a reserve defensive lineman for the Patriots there, just really threw him aside and pushed him out of the way, bowled him over straight to the quarterback for a sack. I think he drew a penalty as well, Barkley did, during the game. So not a great showing for him. But, I mean, can you attribute that, you think, a little bit to just maybe some general angst coming back on a knee that hadn't been tested in a game setting yet? What do you think?
Some of that. Another factor is they don't study opponents, you know, in this stuff before exhibition games. There's, you know, they're in the middle of camp, and like I asked Josh Sitton about this on Saturday, I said, did you look at any of the DTs for New England before that game? He said, no, none.
You mean they didn't watch any tape and go back and look at it?
Yeah. And Barkley and Bakhtiari might have done the same thing. I don't know. They weren't in the room. I didn't have a chance to ask them, but they're just kind of lining up and playing. Everybody's tired, you know, and you just kind of get beat down and you go play. And I mean, I get that. But yet, it was what it was. It wasn't good.
Do you think that trend of not watching tape of opposing defensive players during preseason games, exhibition games, is a league-wide trend, or is it unique to the fact that you think the Packers have such a veteran group on the offensive line?
I think it's definitely a league-wide happening. Players over the years have told me that too. Now, Chandler Jones, did he study Bakhtiari?
Who knows?
Right.
Who knows? Well, we'll have to see how the offensive line comes together. Obviously, it's a veteran group there, but if there is any sort of an injury to Bakhtiari that keeps him out extended time, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out when we go to Pittsburgh next weekend for the game there.
Yeah.
What else do we have on our agenda here? Oh, the defensive backs, the corners in particular. Definitely an area that people were watching entering the first game. I guess really the first thing you noticed when you got to that stadium, Gillette Stadium in New England, was the absence of Demarius Randle, first-round pick who stayed back in Green Bay. Was one of a number of players, actually, who stayed back in Green Bay due to injury. Randle had missed practice on two separate occasions with a little bit of a nagging groin injury, and they didn't risk putting him out there for the first game, so he stayed home. And Quentin Rollins, the second-round pick, took his spot, and I think you and I are in agreement that he put on a nice show for his first professional performance, Bob.
He did. He was aggressive. He was unintimidated. He wasn't in awe of anything. Not that he should be. Brady's playing seven snaps, and the top three wideouts, top tight ends not around. I mean, he's playing against guys who may not even make the team. Boyce was out there constantly, right?
He was targeted about 30 times, Boyce was. They just kept throwing him the ball and throwing him the ball.
But, you know, Brandon Gibson, he played for Miami. He's been around the league about 6 years. He's not a bad player. And Rollins is just all over people.
Yeah.
Now, what did you see that you liked about him?
Well, I guess the first thing that I was impressed with was his real physical style. And we saw it a little bit in camp so far. But because he started the season on the PUP list, he missed a few practices. And then when he came back, they started him in the slot. in the you know, the position there where Micah Hyde would be on one side in the dime and he was on the other, or they would give him reps in the nickel where Hyde is probably going to be the starter. So by the time he moved outside, it was maybe only 3, 4, or 5 practices ago that he really started to settle into that outside position. And in practice, obviously, you're focusing on so many different things going on with drills on one side of the field, drills on the other. It's often hard to focus in on one particular player over the course of a full practice. So to be able to see him in that setting, what I really liked was how when the ball was thrown to him, especially balls where there was a lot of hang time, deep passes down the field, he showed no signs of hesitation going up to try and battle for the ball at the high point when it came down. And not only that, but even though he didn't make interceptions, he actually got hands on a lot of those passes. It wasn't as if he was just jumping and somebody else was out leaping him or pulling it away. He got his hands on the ball, and he and Casey Hayward said that he probably could have walked away with 2 picks from that game, you know, if he had been able to secure a couple of passes there. What did you like about the way he played, other than his poise?
Yeah, from our bad vantage point in the corner, pretty low, which is a bad thing in Foxborough, I'm amazed he didn't come down with at least one of those.
I agree.
He's right on it, man.
Right on it.
Boy, the way he anticipated that back shoulder fade,
yep.
that's a hard route for a rookie to handle. And he played that perfectly. You don't see that from a young player. I like the way he attacked that screen. I don't think he made the tackle, but he sort of disrupted the thing.
And then there was another play where Garoppolo threw to James White out of the backfield, and Rollins put his helmet through White's knee and just completely wiped him out. I mean, hard. White had attention from the trainers, left the field. It was an impressive, impressive, no-nonsense tackle from a rookie.
It was, yeah. So that was Rollins. Now, on practice Saturday, he had a little bit of problems, right, Michael?
He did. Well, he was beaten a couple times. Let's start. We'll save the 2-minute drill for a minute because we are going to talk about that in a little bit more depth. But tell us what you saw in terms of routes against, I think it was Jordy Nelson and Janice. He got beat a couple times.
Yeah. I didn't really see that real good. There was a bunch of players in front of us yesterday, and I didn't really see those routes, so I'm not really sure on that.
We got that from Tom, our partner, who said that he saw it. I guess one was across the middle where Rollins was just too far back in pursuit, and I think another one was along the sideline. But I guess we can move into the 2-minute drill because we did see that. We can shift topics a little bit here. And in the 2-minute drill, toward the end of practice, it was the very last thing that they did yesterday. Brent Huntley went out there, the rookie, and took the first reps. And 2 plays later, they were in the end zone. Both passes, both beautiful throws. The first one was a deep pass down the right sideline for an undrafted rookie, correct? Pinkard?
Larry Pinkard, yes.
It's I've been calling him
Pinkard. Larry says it's Pinkard.
And his nickname is Pink, I assume, right?
He said that. He did. He went with that.
Okay.
Yep.
So a deep pass, I believe it was 57 yards down that right sideline with Rollins in defense. And next play up, Huntley steps up, throws a beautiful slant to Pink again for the touchdown with Rollins in defense. End zone, practice over. 2 plays, 2-minute drill. Were you impressed by that?
Yeah. Huntley made really good throws. And Pink broke that. He had a deep route, and he saw the scramble, and then he kind of stuttered, he said, hesitated, and then he beat Rollins deep. Rollins probably looked back, and rather than keeping his eyes on the ball. And so that was an impressive play by Pinkard. Pinkard's been a pretty good player this whole camp. I mean, when I first saw him in the one OTA practice, he looked real fluid, I thought. And, he's a kid who didn't play college football, at least in a game last year. He got thrown out of Old Dominion, went to Bluefield. The Packers saw him at Bluefield. He couldn't play in a game there. He just practiced. But he's not a bad free agent. He's got a shot to be somewhere here this year.
I think so. I think so as well. But I guess with Rollins playing so well in New England and then coming back and struggling a little bit in the first practice, I would have to think that's just something you expect from a rookie who's going to have up days and down days. You think?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
And
then let's talk a little bit about Huntley. You know, we saw that 2-minute drill where he looked very good. What did you make of his performance there in the second half? I believe he got in the late third or early fourth quarter. I can't remember exactly. But he had, what, 2 drives, I think? 2 possessions?
Yeah, I think he did.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2, and then Blanchard finished,
and then Blanchard
right?
finished the game, yeah. What did you think of his debut?
Handled himself well. He's improving. He looks a lot different than he did in May, and he looks better than he did 2 weeks ago when camp started, the end of July. So I don't know where it goes, but right now he's been good.
I agree. I thought that yesterday in his media session was pretty interesting in the locker room. He sort of, you know, the reporters went up to him and asked, well, did practice feel different today because you had experienced game speed? And he said, no, it was the same as it always was. And they said, well, did something click where maybe when you look back in the playbook, it was a little easier to understand because you'd seen it unfold in a real game with real rushers? And he said, no. Everything was the same. And it was very sort of an interesting demeanor for a guy that was basically saying, look, I understand the questions you're asking me, but there's nothing to see here. This is the way I felt throughout training camp. He said he's felt comfortable with the offense from the very first day. And I thought it was Hundley maybe showing a little bit more, or trying to show a little bit more maturity in terms of how he feels he's doing within this offense. You know, he didn't come out and say things like, man, the game really surprised me at first, but I settled in. Instead, he was very firm, very forceful in what he said. And he said, look, you know, I'm ready for this. I've been preparing. You know, Aaron Rodgers has praised me for the offseason work I did over the summer, and I'm ready to go. So I was sort of that sort of struck me a little bit as just an interesting chord for him to go with, you know, his first media session after the game. It'll be interesting, I guess, to see how he plays out. I was a little surprised he got in the game before Blanchard. Were you?
No.
No? Okay.
You know, it seemed like that practice rotation had kind of switched early last week.
That's true. The beginning of camp, yeah. Blanchard was taking the third-string reps there after Tolzien, and then it had switched to Hundley. But only one series for Blanchard to close the game there.
Yeah. I mean, some places these fours never even get on the field. The Packers drafted Jay Barker in the fifth round in 1984.
Okay.
He never played in a game.
Wow.
He's from Alabama. He didn't win the Heisman, did he? No.
I don't think so.
National title, I think. I think he did. He had a great one-loss record. Never even got in a game.
It's tough.
Yeah.
Quarterback's a tough job. But before we shift topics, we got to go back to the corners a little bit because I do want to talk for a moment about Ladarius Gunter.
Yeah.
He had a nice play there, made an interception against New England, a pass where he actually thought it was going to be a go route down the left sideline. He said it ended up being a stick where the receiver stopped short. So he broke back to the ball and sort of thrust his left hand basically into the midsection of the receiver and then ended up popping the ball into the air. He caught it and went the other way. This is a guy who's made some plays throughout training camp. You know, sort of give the readers a little bit of an impression of what the reputation was of him coming out of college and sort of how he has, what he has excelled at through the first couple of weeks of camp.
So he's 6'1.5", you know, fits the profile. Everybody in the league wants that height. But despite that great attribute, he wasn't picked because he had a bad 40 time, you know. I don't know what it was, 4.67, 4.65, or 4.69, something
yeah,
like that.
High 4.6s for sure.
It was brutal. So he goes as a free agent. He played some safety at Miami. He's a physical kid.
Long arms.
Yeah, he does. And so I don't know. He's played pretty darn good so far. And he's got a real shot to make the team. I mean, Dimitri Goodson's been injured with his calf now for about a week.
Now Randall's out again. We don't know when he's going to be back. McCarthy thought that he might be able to practice yesterday, but sure enough, he wasn't out there. So he when he went through his pre-practice tests, he obviously didn't pass to the liking of the training staff. So who knows? I mean, he's taken advantage of the fact that he's gotten extra reps, dating back to the beginning of camp when Rollins was injured, and he got some of those reps.
Yeah.
So he's got two interceptions of Aaron Rodgers in 11-on-11 drills in practice, the only corner who can say that at this point in the season, and he makes the only interception in the first exhibition game. Obviously, it was against, you know, the backups and things like that. It wasn't as if he picked off, you know, number 12 up there in New England or anything, but still. I mean, if the coaches say that the young guys need to make plays, he's continuing to do so, it seems.
His first name, the spelling of his first name has been an issue.
Yes. Well, not as much the spelling, the capitalization of his first name. So it's Ladarius, L-A-D-A-R-I-U-S. And you went up and you asked him about this.
I approached Mr. Gunter about that, and he really said it didn't matter.
In terms of the capital D?
What to do with the D, yeah. And so I said, well, it matters to us. You tell us how you want it, and that's the way it'll be forevermore in the Journal Sentinel until you tell us different. And again, he was just noncommittal, and I said, well, what do you want? And he goes, capital D. I said, done.
And it's interesting because Bob told me this, so I immediately went on the internet, and I looked to see what his bio was at the University of Miami, lowercase d. I went on Twitter to see if he had a Twitter profile, lowercase d. So it's very strange. I don't know if he just decided that he wanted this capitalized for print or what. But Ladarius, you have your capital D, and it will remain throughout the season.
Maybe we have to revisit it. I didn't know that was all. It was all small D before.
It was all small D, but he wants the capital letter D there in his name. So that's what we've got.
I think we could persuade him to do either or. You know.
Yeah. Now, obviously, we had a question there about capitalization. We will stick with the somewhat of a grammar category here and talk about. Pennell, a defensive lineman here, who we are not sure if it's Pennell. We're gonna go with
Pennell.
Mike Pennell, number 64, a nose tackle. He showed pretty well, I thought, in that first exhibition game, both in terms of what he did football-wise and also conditioning-wise. Our colleague Tom wrote about that the other day. What did you see on tape when you watched his performance?
He got off a couple blocks and made a couple plays, although he did that last year in these exhibition games, too. He really did. There was times he had some dominant. That's how he made the team. I mean, he kicked some second- and third-string centers' butts here last August, made the club. So I didn't see a big change there. I think his body, the weight's a little bit better distributed. He's a little bit more definition to his body. He hustled in pursuit two or three times. You saw him range, you know, way past the numbers. That was impressive. I thought he had a good game.
One of the things that the article in today's paper written by, you know, Tom, our colleague, pointed out was that they lined him up in different locations than he had been used in the past a little bit. Now, I wasn't here last year, so can you kind of fill us in on how he was used last year compared to where we saw him the other night?
Last year, boy, was he ever a base end? I don't, in the 3-4.
He was almost always a nose, right?
Only as an emergency on a game day if somebody got hurt. He was a nose, and then, you know, in the exhibition games, he would play inside in some pass rush situations, and that was it.
And then that changed a little bit because we saw him play a little bit of end.
Right.
He still played some of his nose. And then how was he used in the nickel?
Just as an inside rusher,
inside
you know, one
rusher.
Of the two
okay.
guys. You know, I call, you can debate this, Michael. I know, I always, the nickel, I call it a 4-2. The dime, I call it a 4-1. Now, some people say, well, those outside guys are not ends, they generally are standing up. I said, I know, but they're functioning as ends, and in football words, you use 3-4, 4-1, 4-2, and so I'm just going with that, as opposed to a 2-5 or those kind of things.
Fair enough.
All right.
Another guy that showed maybe a little bit of flash on the inside was Gaston, number 99, Bruce Gaston, a defensive tackle there. I don't know what his record is in the one-on-one drills that you track so well, the offensive line, defensive line one-on-one drills, but he has made some nice moves that I've seen anyway. Like I said, I don't know what his overall record is, but I thought he's done well and showed some glimpses there. And he showed up again a little bit on the tape the other night.
He was pretty active, 26 snaps. You know, when he got here last December, that was his fourth team in like 6 months. And the reason he had four teams interested in him is because he's got some juice. Mike Turgovec said that old cliche word that's kind of become a cliche here recently. And when you say a guy's got some juice, it means he's got the ability to rush the passer. That's kind of what it means. And he's really a big guy. He's up to 318, and he does. I mean, he looked pretty good on stunts, wheeling around the outside, and he's got some hand usage, and he's got some get off. He's got a little game to him, man. So I don't know how he is against the run yet. I'm not sure about that, but he's fighting Kyrie Thornton and Christian Ringo for a job. You know, LaVon Hooks is not a bad free agent either, so we'll see about Gaston. He needs a couple more good performances, that's for sure.
Before we switch off the defensive line entirely, how do you think the suspensions to Dayton Jones, one game there, and LaTroy Guyon, who it was reported had a three-game suspension, but as we know has an appeal hearing later this month. How do you think that those situations where there will definitely be down two guys, probably at least for one game, will influence maybe some of the defensive line positions behind them?
Somebody's going to make that team early in the year that normally wouldn't.
Is there anyone that's
beyond that,
that
I really
got your eye on?
Well, we've mentioned them all here. You know, I mean, Thornton's got to go. Ringo's got to go. Gaston has to go. Hooks, you know.
And Boyd is in there, too. We saw him get banged up a little bit as well. Josh Boyd.
Boyd's a pretty good player. He had a knee scope in the offseason. But, I mean, he earned his Spurs last year. He did some good things. He's an active guy as well. And he can play across the line and knock some people around. I like Boyd, so he's just got to get healthy. So, Mike, you did a story the other day on the inside backers. And in New England, Clay Matthews sat it out. And Barrington started at the strong inside. And Nate Palmer started on the weak inside. What did you see?
Well, it was sort of an interesting situation because we had seen for a while with Matthews dealing with that knee soreness and missing a few practices, we had seen that it was going to be Barrington and Palmer at those two inside backer spots. The question was, in what order would the guys, you know, appear behind them? And basically what we saw is Barrington played the fewest number of snaps, which is to be expected, and then when he left, Palmer stayed in for maybe three or four more snaps, and he was joined by Carl Bradford. Bradford is a guy who came from Arizona State, where he was a outside linebacker, defensive end, sort of hybrid player there. Shifted to inside backer, I believe you said, after the third exhibition game last year. Mm-hmm. So he's continuing to learn that position. And so he played with Palmer for a few snaps as sort of that first inside backer off the bench. And then Palmer got his rest, and he was done for the night. And in came Jake Ryan, a rookie. And then those two guys played the majority of the snaps throughout the game. Bradford played 56% of the snaps defensively, and Jake Ryan played 71%. Both guys, I thought, flashed a little bit. You know, you saw Jake Ryan with two tackles for loss, a beautiful sack where he split right between a defensive tackle and an outside linebacker and recorded a 7-yard loss on Garoppolo. And you saw Bradford, he had a sack as well on a beautifully timed blitz, which is something that he has done well a few times in camp. He times his blitzes pretty well in certain situations. But you also saw some rookie mistakes. I know both those guys aren't rookies. Bradford obviously isn't, but some young guy mistakes is what I mean there. You saw Bradford, I talked to him yesterday, and he said when he watched the tape, I thought this was interesting. You often hear players say that they are thinking too much when they watch themselves, and they think that they were slow. Bradford sort of took that and brought it in a different direction. He said when he went back on tape, he was thinking too much, but he was really pleased with his thought process in that he made the correct decision a lot of times. The problem was just the speed with which he could take that decision and turn it into action. So that's his next step, he said, is taking the correct reads, which he said he had against New England, and applying them faster so that he can react quicker and get to situations a little bit more promptly. Ryan, on the other hand, had a little bit of a snafu on special teams that needed some correction along the sidelines. The coaches came over and had to, fix a mistake that he made there. But he played pretty well. He had six total tackles, which was tied for which was the second highest on the team behind Jayron Elliott, who had seven. And, they looked all right. Palmer steady, but there was that 55-yard touchdown run by Jonas Gray that was scored against the starters. And I know you talked to Palmer about that yesterday. Sort of give us a little bit of a taste of what he said unfolded on that play and what you saw as well when you looked at the tape.
I'm not even sure if Palmer was in his proper gap. I think he was, but I'm not sure. But then he has that club on that left hand, right, Mike? And Gray was to Palmer's left, and Palmer was engaged with a blocker, and he put that left club out, and he could not really grasp the guy to impede him, slow him down.
So Jonas Gray turns the corner, scampers 55 yards, and that's the only touchdown the defense gave up all night. The only touchdown. Yeah. And you go back and watch that play, as Bob and I did, and you notice that Barrington was engaged with a lineman who at the same time tripped, whether inadvertently or not, I don't know, Clinton Dix as he was trying to make the tackle. There were two more players. Micah Hyde was one of them. The other one eludes me at the moment. Oh, Andy Malumba were both engaged as well. So it kind of came down to Palmer trying to reach out, as you said. And with that club, I mean, he's got no fingers exposed. He might have his thumb exposed, I think, maybe. That's the only one sticking out there. There's nothing you can do to make a tackle in that situation.
No, he's playing one-handed, and it's a tough goal. But I believe, Mike, the play has to be made by Clinton Dix.
Okay.
The angle coming down from center field on that thing was too severe, too sharp. He had to, And that's why he was able to be kind of caught in that mix. He had to have a better angle more towards outside. It's his play to make, you know, really, and it wasn't made.
And I know that when I first got this job, you sent me all your season review stories from last year where you evaluated the positions, and that was one of the first things you noted about Clinton Dix is too many missed tackles. But you have to expect that from a young guy, so we'll have to see how he sort of adapts this year. But there was no question that that was a deficiency last year, correct?
Yeah, and you can't expect missed tackles. Those mistakes like that are just unforgivable.
Okay.
This 55-yard run, you know, with a bad angle and a miss, I mean, you just can't have it. A defense that's worth its salt cannot have that.
So those have to be trimmed out this year if Clinton Dix wants to shore up the back half of that secondary alongside right. Morgan Burnett.
Yep.
So that kind of covers pretty much everything that's going on with this year's team. But one of the things that you and I talk about a lot, because I haven't been here over the years, is some Packers history that you continue to educate me on. And one of the questions that I asked you the other day was, Bob, in all your years covering the team, back, you know, what do we got? Is this your fourth decade?
Well,
you got the 80s, the 90s?
I started 90s? Being a backup in about 79, 80, okay? Full-time starting in May of 84.
Okay.
So continuous ever since.
So long before I was born and is when you got your start. And one of the things I asked you is way back then when the journalism business was a little bit different and still adapting and evolving was, did you ever fly on the Packers team plane? Or did any media fly on the team plane? And there was something going on at practice. We didn't get a chance to finish up the answer. But you dug into your clippings, and you've got some stories for me.
So the answer is no, I never did. But I wasn't on the beat then when this practice ended. Okay, so I'll just, let's see. When I started at the Green Bay Press Gazette in December of 75, we were an afternoon newspaper. You know, there aren't almost none of these around the country now, but that's, you know, the paper boys would deliver that afternoon edition after school, 3-4 o'clock. You'd be, you know, everybody got home from work then at 5, and the father and the mother would sit there and read the paper at night at 5 o'clock, 4:30. The deadline, that edition went to press at about noon, 11:30 a.m. So the Press Gazette, the Milwaukee Journal, these newspapers were afternoon papers. So in all those early years with the Packers, well, they started flying, and I think in about 1949, maybe, 1950. Prior to that, it was all train trips out east where all the teams were.
Can you imagine a train trip out east and back?
Really something, huh? Really something. So, you know, afternoon papers. So the game would end. The writers would, some of them didn't even go in the locker rooms at that point. They'd leave the press box and accompany the team, you know, on the team charter, and they would fly back to Green Bay. Then these guys would go to their offices or hotels, wherever, write the story. You had till noon the next day, so no problem. The Press Gazette stayed an afternoon paper until, 85, 84, something like that. Now let's go to the plane travel. Okay, I believe the Press Gazette was on that team charter until 1976, maybe 77. So was the Milwaukee Journal, I believe. The Milwaukee Sentinel was in a morning paper, so I'm sure they didn't. They had to write in the press box because they had a deadline, say on an 11 p.m. deadline, let's just say. Okay, so they had to get their work done in the press box. When did the practice of media people on the plane end? Well, so I was a youngster at the Green Bay Press Gazette at that point, observing our Packer coverage. And the Packers were really poor when I got there, 75, 76, 77. And the Press Gazette's coverage was extremely aggressive. The team had been founded in the newspaper office in 1919 in a meeting with the sports editor, George Whitney Calhoun, and Curly Lambeau, and Andrew Turnbull, who at the time was the business manager of the Press Gazette. He was involved there as well. So, Daniel Beisel became publisher of the Press Gazette in 1963. And how Beisel got in here, he married a Turnbull daughter. And Turnbull later became president of the Packers in about 1930, early 30s, something like that. And he married his daughter. And then at some point, Daniel Beisel became a member of the Packer Board of Directors. Now, we can discuss that conflict of interest at another time. But
just a little.
So Beisel was a member of that 45-man board, and Bart Starr was named head coach and general manager in January of 75. And the team had a very poor year, and in 70 they were 4-10, non-competitive. In 76 they were 5-9, and in 77 they were 4-10. They scored 134 points in 77. I think that's the lowest in club history. The highest points they scored after 24 in the opener, Mike, in a victory over the Saints, they never scored more than 16 in the last 13 games. Okay. So the board met quarterly, as they do now, four times a year. And there was the Press Gazette had written some highly critical stories of Starr and the team, questioning a lot of the moves he was making. And I believe there was a cartoon or two on our editorial pages making fun of the Packers and their rebuilding effort. And at that board of directors meeting, Bart Starr gave his quarterly address, and he directed his remarks at Daniel Beisel, the publisher of the Press Gazette, for not being supportive, for being turning his back on the organization that was founded in that newspaper's newsroom, embarrassed him in front of all these captains of industry from Green Bay and the state of Wisconsin. And Beisel took it very, very personally. And I think within a week or two, he informed the Packers that no Press Gazette employee would ever ride on that team charter again. This was a massive step. I mean, a feud between the Press Gazette, which for the first 40, 50 years of its existence was a house organ for the team, and the Packers. And that's the way, so I was never on that. And I know our writer was pulled off that plane, and from that day forward, we made our own reservations. That's what we do to this day. Couldn't be doing it now anyway, because we're working in that press box every night till 11, and the team's back in Green Bay on a noon start. They're back in Green Bay by 7. We're still working till 11, so that wouldn't have worked anyway. But
be a little bit better than those crack of dawn wake-ups we have for our flights back on Monday mornings.
Does this practice go on around the league? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
How long did it go beyond this, the way it ended in Green Bay? I think for a few years. Yeah. I think definitely for a few years after that. But that's the way it ended in Green Bay.
Yeah, it's just always sort of interested me to hear about the way things were done, you know, way back. And I don't know, I couldn't really imagine flying on the plane now, you know? I mean, it's kind of like that's their personal space, I guess, in a way, is how I view it. You know, the team goes on the plane, we go our own way, and, you know, they might not be happy with the questions we ask or the things we write after a game. And to then have to share a plane with them, I think, would be a little bit of miss.
It's no place for us.
No place for us.
Absolutely not, Mike.
Instead, we wake up at 4 a.m., we make the drive to the airport, and Bob comes back and watches film on Monday mornings and about an hour and a half of sleep.
That's about it.
Well, is it time to cue up the doors again? Are you ready for a little bit more?
Let's bring it on.
All right.
Mr. Morrison, Manzarek, Densmore, and Krieger.
All right, so that's Bob's choice for this week. I'll be back with another selection next week. Thank you all for listening.
Yep, thanks, guys.
Don't you love her badly? Don't you need her badly? Don't you love her ways? Tell me what you say. Don't you love her badly? Wanna be her daddy? Don't you love her face? Don't you love her?
It never happens at a good time. The pipe bursts at midnight. The heater quits on the coldest night. Suddenly, you're overwhelmed. That's when Home Service here. For $4.99 a month, you're never alone. Just call their 24/7 hotline and a local pro is on the way. Trusted by millions, Home Serve delivers peace of mind when you need it most. For plans starting at just $4.99 a month, go to homeserve.com. That's homeserve.com. Not available everywhere. Most plans range between $4.99 to $11.99 a month your first year. Terms apply on covered repairs.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.